The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Heretics Hour on Monday, March 31st, 2015. Tomorrow is April Fool's Day. Actually, April Fool is a concept that I've never liked. You know, when I was, I remember in school, grade school especially, but probably later on too, if you forgot it was April Fool's Day, you could very easily find yourself caught in a little trick and get fooled, and sometimes it wasn't very much fun. I never like surprising things like that, so I'm glad my program's not on April Fool's Day this year. I'm going to start out talking about some problems. My sound's doing real well, so I can move back. I'm going to start out talking about some problems within white nationalism. Now, am I an expert in white nationalism? Not at all. But I do wonder if anyone is. I feel like I'm out of the loop altogether, if there is a loop. I probably have gotten to where I'm staying in a very tight little circle when I'm online, and I don't look at a lot of things. I'm not very interested in, or maybe if I started looking at them again, I might get interested, but I'm losing interest, ladies and gentlemen, in an awful lot of, this movement, as far as, keeping up or whatever, and there's not a lot to keep up with. So I don't know though if I'm missing out. But I wonder if anybody is, how we even define white nationalism anymore. And I've talked about this for a long time. You know, I have this critical attitude toward it. And I say, I don't know really what white nationalism means. It doesn't feel, I don't feel real comfortable with it. And then other times I say, well, yeah, sure I do. I mean, I know what it means. But maybe it's because there's such a variety, and I like for things to be clearly defined. People know what they're doing, you know, what page you're on, and people to be pretty much in agreement and then move forward. But we don't have that. There's a lot of differences of opinion, I guess you'd say, or a lot of different points of view, and people seeming to, not like other people, and I'm one of those people that doesn't like some other people, so there's not anything too strange there. I said that I was going to take callers tonight, but I have to wait until the second hour. I have a caller already. I'm kind of tempted to answer it, but I won't be able to, you know, it'll mess up my program so much. So I would ask this caller to please call after the break. And I might be really glad that I've done that, because I don't know who it might be. So this is a 2-hour show. So after the first hour, we'll have our musical interlude in the middle, and then I'll answer your call. Thanks. So I'm going to start out, as I said, asking, well, maybe the white nationalist problem is partly an internet problem. We know that everything good, I tried to hang that up, but it didn't work. I wonder why. They're still there. There it goes. An internet problem. We know that everything good has its bad side, and everything bad has its good side. So the internet, I would say, is mostly good. But it also brings some bad along with it. And so then I asked the question, do websites and their commenters, there's that call again, same one. I already told them that I couldn't answer their call until the second hour, so they can stop calling unless they're just trying to irritate me. Don't reveal anything. Do websites and their commenters make up a community? That's the question I'm asking, because I'm going to talk about some comments here.
Good evening.
Well, Dr. Messerly.
How are you?
You're really screwing up my whole system here. I don't know what's done. You're on. Yeah, you're on. Okay. All right.
All right.
I answered it, and I was trying to do something else. Well, you know, I did invite you on the show, but you never answered me.
What was that?
I said I did invite you on tonight's show, but you didn't answer me.
I sent you a reply today, this around noon.
Oh, well, I probably didn't look then, so I may
you
not.
See, I did. Yeah, I did reply. Sorry.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm glad you're here, but at the same time, I prepared a whole show, and I forget what we were going to. I know we were going to. Okay. Well, you know what?
You had something about the occult roots of the NSDAP, about which I don't know a thing, you know. But I might give you a few hints about the Slavic, Pan-Slavism and Slavic culture and all that.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted to talk about originally,
right.
But I didn't hear back from you, so I thought, well, probably I wasn't. Maybe it was too much last minute. So, well, why don't, you know, if you don't mind just hanging on while I do a little of this preliminary that I was going to take care of. I really don't want to leave this out. Okay. And then we'll start in on the Slavic question, because I did want you to come on and talk about that, because you are you're pretty much an expert. Although I'm afraid I don't have the questions prepared, but maybe they'll come to my mind. All right. Okay, so just stay tight there. I'm really sorry that it's turned out this way, because, you know, I respect you so much, but just hold on for, five minutes or so, okay?
Okay. And you know, what happened was that yesterday we went to the opera. We were gone for about something like, 6 or 7 hours.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't have time to reply yesterday.
I see. Yes, I know. Well,
I replied today, you know, so.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, there you go. Sometimes that happens. We just don't, the timing of things just doesn't work out right. So, okay, just hold on here. Now, I was going to talk about comments and comment boards that are not moderated as far as the community that we have. And these comment boards, in my opinion, attract trolls and Jews, because, you know, anything goes on there. If you can't, you know, if every comment that is written goes up, then more and more people come and make comments there, because they know they're going to not be turned down. And that can increase traffic for the site. And that's one reason that people like comments. I like having comments at the White Network. But we do moderate all of our comments there. Now, here is a comment that I just I'm going to save that one. First, I want to talk a little bit about this Reichenberg, who is commenting at the Daily Stormer and has recently been chasing after me and criticizing me in every way that he can think of. And I just want to point out one here that is. Just one back and forth here that is an example of this. And this is, this person that calls himself Reichenberg, has been targeting, you know, I said that already, but he's not German. He uses this name, but it's very clear from many, many back and forths that he doesn't know German or Germany. He's not German, but he named himself Reichenberg. But he will never say what he is or what he, you know, what his background is.
Yeah.
Now, he wrote here, I agree, we must unite to evade the destruction of our race. It's a matter of life. Well, they were talking about something else. Then he says, I would like to correct you on one point. He's talking to somebody else. It's basically only Carolyn Jaeger who is sowing the seed of discord here. First, all Slavs were inferior, and now the only superior race is just the Germans, according to her. She is starting to lose it. By the way, she is not full German either, only half German. I suspect she is compensating. Now, this tells me, and it would tell anybody who knew, that he has no idea whether I'm half German or full German, but he's just putting this in here because he thinks maybe I won't notice it and he'll get away with it and there'll be some misinformation put out there. People will accept it. So I wrote, I saw it there, and I said, there you go again, Arberg. I started calling him Arberg, with your disinformation campaign. You're a troll, maybe a Jewish troll, since you so show all the signs. I, Carolyn Jaeger, am 100% German. I'm just trying to make it clear, you see. Put it on the record. With four German grandparents, why would I lie about it since I'm not a liar? What is your ethnic ancestry, Arberg? Well, he doesn't answer his ancestry, but he answers me and says, well, I read somewhere you have only two. My mistake. I admit I was wrong. So, do you think being 100% German makes you infallible? Now, you see what he's doing here. He brings up my ancestry, not me, because he thinks it matters. And then when I correct him and state that I am, you know, I have four German grandparents, he then makes out that I brought it up and says, do you think it makes you infallible, somebody special, to be 100% German? And so, you know, I wasn't making that point, but he twists it around that way. So he's obviously jealous of Germans, or is anti-German, while he pretends to be a National Socialist. This is sneaky and dishonest. And this is what you run into all the time in these kind of unmoderated comments, and sometimes in moderated comments. And then, you know, you just, if you go and you try to correct the record, you get into more and more stuff with these people. Now, I just happened before today's program to see, because I was looking for something else at the Daily Stormer, and I saw that there was a comment to Tan Staffel's radio program from this past Tuesday. And I thought, I don't think I saw that before, so I clicked on it. And I guess I had thought it was a pingback, but it wasn't. It turned out to be a comment from Reichenberg, March 28th, a few days ago. And he says, and he writes this, Andre, I'd like to gently direct your awareness to this article. And it's an article from Destroy Zionism from 1913, May. And it was that one that said, you know, it was about Tan Staffel. And they just found out that Tan Staffel's wife was half Jewish, and they hadn't known that, and they thought that was a big thing, and asked some questions about it. And so he links to that, and then Reichenberg says the comment section is especially revealing. Yeah, well, I have some comments in there, so I guess so. Now, he says, I'm not a defender of Rodney Martin. He certainly has his faults, but I believe he was criticized, ostracized, and chased away by Carolyn Jaeger for much less than this. So there you go. Now, I've notified Andre of this. We'll see what happens with it. But this is the kind of thing that's old news. It's been dealt with. I had a whole blog post on the White Network about it, people have pretty much come around to accepting it, and not because Tan has never made it a secret. So he's just trying to – he obviously is out of the loop himself. He obviously doesn't know what's going on, or else he's just trying to start something up. But I don't think this person is an honest, sincere person. And this is a problem that we have, that the Internet brings to this – to the white nationalist movement. I think it keeps us from being, you know, if you are a recognized, if you use your real name and you're talking, the name that you use is something that everybody knows, and they know things about you, and you know, it's you're not a hidden person who's has no who has no information out there about yourself, then whatever you say, whatever it is, even if it's criticism of other people, you're taking responsibility for it. But if you're one of these people who are just sneaking around with their screen names and are not revealing anything about themselves, but this Reichenberg has gotten to be quite the commenter. He writes quite a few every day. Then you're not taking responsibility for what you're saying. You don't have to. So that's the difference. There's nothing wrong if you're a known person to say things and it's known that you said them and you have to answer for them. But these people are not answering for anything. All right. Well, I had my agenda here, but I've had several thoughts about this program. So Dr. Andreas Vesterle is with us, and he has been my guest several times before. And I know we did a program a while back, Dr. Vesterle, about because I wanted to know more about the Slavs and what made them tick, and what I don't remember exactly how that went, but I was talking a lot about the end of World War II and how the Germans were treated. So we went into all of that, and I was going to, for this program, I was going to listen to that again, but I didn't do it. So I don't know where to start with asking you, because I don't have anything in my notes here, but I would like you to go through, if you can, about Pan-Slavism. And also remind us which countries that we consider Eastern Europe, sort of, or Baltic countries and so on, whatever is not, Western Europe, which of these countries, because some of them are not Slavic. And as I recall, Hungary and Romania and also the Baltic countries were not, and maybe a couple more. So could you do that for us?
Central Europe, it's made up mostly of German peoples, and until 1945, the great expulsion of many people from Eastern Europe and Central Europe, including the Finns and various people in the Balkans and so on, which comes to about 21 or 22 million people. They were expelled from their homes, homes which they had occupied in some cases for over 1,000 years.
And just to be open about all this, full disclosure, you were one of those people.
Exactly.
You and your family, and you were still a boy at that time.
Right.
Okay.
Anyway, the German element was a very great part of that entire geographic and cultural picture, in Central and Eastern Europe.
And, now, when you said that, including the Finns and the Baltics, did you mean that they also expelled Germans from their countries, or they themselves were expelled?
They were expelled themselves, right? Like the Finns from northern Finland and Karelia, which is the eastern country of Finland, bordering on Russia. And when they signed the armistice and the peace a document with the Soviet Union in 1944 and later on, they were compelled to accept many hundreds of thousands. I don't know exactly how many at the moment. Of course, Finland, they're a small country population-wise. And then a heavy influx of Finns from Karelia, the borderland between Finland and Russia, which they had to take up. And then also some of the Eastern Poles were expelled from Eastern Poland. However, they were compensated, unfortunately, by German lands, which were taken from Germany east of the Oder River, roughly. And some of those lands were given to the Eastern Poles. Sure can argue about that, but there were quite a few Poles expelled also from Eastern Poland. Now, we used to be called Eastern Poland. East of the Curzon line. The Hungarians were expelled, first of all, after the First World War, and then again after the Second World War. Many millions of Hungarians were expelled from Czechoslovakia and, to some extent, from Romania and especially Yugoslavia. And there were also many expulsions involving Turks or people descended from the Turks or Muslim peoples in Bulgaria and Yugoslavia who were thrown out into Turkey. So the whole swath of countries had to give up, millions and millions of people. And among those, there were about 14 and a half or 15 million Germans who were expelled from Central and Eastern Europe in 1944, 1945, 46, and driven west. The survivors, of course, many, several million died. Survivors settled in the Soviet zone of Germany and in Western Germany, Austria, mainly, much lesser extent also in Switzerland and Denmark and Sweden and so on. There was a tremendous uprooting of people.
Sometimes okay, well, let me ask you, would you please say, what was the justification? Well, we know what was going on, so, I mean, we know that history, but was there really any justification for expelling these people?
Actually, there was not. Churchill put it very distinctly. He said, well, in the past centuries and so on, these people always were at loggerheads with each other, and there was conflict between this and that, which is, of course, not totally true anyway. But that's what he said. There was a lot of conflict in Eastern Germany, in old Eastern Germany, and Bohemia, and Hungary, and Serbia, and Croatia, and all that. Therefore, if we expel all these people from there, even if many of them, of course, would be killed or die on the way, the survivor then will merge with the old Germans and Soviet zone of Germany and in Western Germany and in Austria, and they'll, from then on there will be peace. That's more or less Churchill's argument.
Well, yeah, Churchill's argument was exactly the opposite of what's said today, that people of different ethnicity should be together. They shouldn't be mixed. They shouldn't be mixed together.
Right.
They should be separated.
Right.
Yeah, and now they won't allow people to be separated. They want to mix everyone together. And that happened almost right away.
Right.
So do you think Churchill meant what he said? I think he kind of did, but he didn't really understand the whole picture. What do you think about how much Churchill understood about what he was doing?
Well, he may have understood the human cost of it, but he didn't care. As long as millions of people would die, as long as they're not British, he didn't care about it. So that was really pretty much his attitude. Another thing is that he was a weak man out. He could not compete against Roosevelt or against Stalin. He was just too weak militarily and politically. So whatever he said would have made not much difference. There's a famous book by a gentleman named Hobson, who was a liberal politician around 1910. And he was a colleague of the young Churchill in 1910 in the cabinet, the liberal prime minister of Britain at that time. And he said that Churchill was very talented, very gifted, but otherwise he was an SOB, you know, that's more or less what he called him.
Yeah.
And Churchill would be very ready to sacrifice anything as long as he could save his own skin. And that's what actually, that's what happened. Churchill threw everything overboard that he supposedly held dear before that, including the British Empire, which supposedly expropriated by the United States, you know. And just so long as Britain could survive and hold on for some time. Well, let me make another comment. Stalin in 1944 was supposed to have said to Tito from Yugoslavia that from then on, from 1944 on, and after the end of the Second World War, it would be the age of the Slavs. The Slavs would conquer Europe, and then he, Tito, and Stalin, even though Stalin was definitely not a Slav, but a Georgian, and then not related to the Slavs or any other Indo-European people. But Stalin became very Russianized, and he said that the Slavs would take over, they would rule Eurasia, or as in Stalin's view, anything from the British Channel to Japan would be in the hands of the Slavs. And then, of course, in parentheses.
Now, this was Stalin said this? This was Stalin's
Stalin said that to Tito in 1944.
Okay. Oh, well, maybe he was just trying to get Tito to, you know, he's just trying to smooth talk Tito.
I mean, maybe so, yeah.
But still, he said it, yeah.
Stalin had very much taken on the values of the Muscovite Russian nation, called the Great Russian Nation. And he thought that the Great Russians or the Muscovite Russians were really terrific, and it was up to them to capture predominance over Eurasia, you know, from the English Channel all the way up to Japan.
Gee, do you think that Putin's idea, the way he's talking now about Eurasia, is very much similar to Stalin's idea about Eurasia?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as that.
Okay.
But it was influenced by that, yeah. There was a famous Spanish conservative in the 19th century, first half of the 19th century. His name was Donoso Cortez. And he hated the Russians. and even though the Russians defeated the French under Napoleon I, to some extent anyway, but Cortez thought that the Russians were out. This was under the Tsars, of course, in the first half of the 19th century. The Russians were out to dominate, not just dominate, but to rule Europe from Spain all the way to Japan, including Siberia and all that. Of course, it has not happened, but it does not mean that some Russians or some parts of the Russian nation don't have that kind of imagination, that kind of fantasy, you know, to rule Eurasia.
What is Eurasia? Would you give us the geographical boundaries of that, please?
Well, all of Europe and Asia, because Europe is just a series of peninsula jutting out west of Asia. You know, if you stand at the Ural Mountains in eastern Russia, eastern European Russia, and you look west, mm-hmm. pretty much all you see is, except for the steppes of Russia, of course. But beyond that, all of Europe is just a series of islands or peninsulae, like Scandinavia and Central and Western Europe and the Iberian Peninsula, Italy, Greece, and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah. So so Eurasia means all of Europe.
Right.
I didn't know that. I was thinking that it was actually, you know, the Eastern Europe, the part that Russia would like to have that it used to have there in Eastern Europe, and then on, you know, into Asia, or maybe it was just the Southern Russia, those that Russia doesn't have anymore, those independent nations, things like that. But it's really the entire continent. Of both continents.
Right.
Together.
Right.
Wow.
Of course.
I wonder, is that what they mean? Is that what they mean today is that what Putin and his, say, Alexander Dugin and people like that, when they talk about Eurasia, is that what they mean?
Possibly. The thing is that you have to consider at the same time that Uncle Sam, you know, since 1917, since Woodrow Wilson, but especially since 1991, with the breakdown, with the demise of the Soviet Empire, Uncle Sam has been pretty much ruthless in grabbing as much as he can, especially for Wall Street. You know, Wall Street has been expanding crazily. Into especially the countries around the Caspian Sea, because it's rich oil and gas resources, and expanding into Eastern, into Central Europe, not that too, and Central Asia, because of its rich oil and gas resources, expanding into Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan's supposed to be the country through which a pipeline, the oil and gas pipeline, will be channeled from Central Asia, especially from Turkmenistan or the Caspian Sea, through Afghanistan to Pakistan, where then the American ships would load it on them, you know, and take all this precious cargo to New York or Los Angeles or God knows where all these Wall Street characters could make billions and billions and trillions and quadrillions of dollars, you know. So to some extent, it's been pretty one-sided on the side of Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam meaning being totally dominated by Wall Street.
Okay, well, now, so then... You see the U.S. Wall Street, U.S. Conglomerate here as being wanting to take over all of Europe and Asia. I mean, it's not really, it's just, you see it as kind of like using Europe. I mean, not feeling like Europe is a real partner, but just wanting to have Europe on its side.
Right. It's a kind of a recreation of the somewhat smaller competition between Tsarist Russia and Imperial Britain around 1900 and 1903 at that time, with a clash in Afghanistan, you know. And actually, the huge, that kind of a panhandle of northeastern Afghanistan that juts out east and divides what used to be Tsarist Russia in the north from British India in the south, mainly what now is Pakistan and India and Nepal and Tibet, for that matter. That panhandle was created at that time in 1905 when the British and the Russians more or less settled matters. And the Russians, for that time anyway, decided not to invade Afghanistan and not to take India away from the British, because in 1904, 1905, the British very astutely and very brutally and ruthlessly, as always, with the Japanese up against the Russians, seeing that the Russians were also being a danger to Japan at that time in 1904 in Manchuria and northern Korea. So the British more or less told the Japanese, hey, look at the Russians, they're trying to take over Eastern Asia, that means Japan, so you better attack them. So that's what the Japanese did. They attacked Manchuria, which at that time was to a large extent a sphere of influence of Tsarist Russia. And the Japanese defeated the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time that Teddy Roosevelt brought about the peace of which earned him the Nobel Peace Prize, which he actually didn't deserve.
Teddy Roosevelt got the Nobel Peace Prize?
Right. For making peace between the Hirohito of Japan and the Russian Tsar.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, and so what's happening now is there's no real power competition because Russia still is too weak to totally threaten the United States. But Uncle Sam has more or less stepped into the imperial galoshes, the imperial boots of Britain of 1905 and 1910 and all that, and has taken over all those countries that Britain wanted to take over in around 1900 and before the First World War, you know.
Well, what is your what is your opinion of the U.S.? Is it all bad? Is it you see it as the bad guy in the world today?
Of course not. It's really thrown its weight around. But we have to realize that the United States or the people in the United States are being ruled in a thousand different ways, propaganda and secret police and all that stuff, you know.
Well, yeah, so I didn't mean the people of the United States, but I meant the government of the United States. Is that the main bad element in the world today, in your opinion?
Well, it's the main expansive element, yeah.
Okay.
There's a very interesting book published by the University of Wisconsin Press, which just came out a few months ago, by an individual named Drake, D-R-A-K-E. It's about the famous Wisconsin senator and governor, fighting Bob La Follette.
Mm-hmm.
And La Follette, it's called the Education of Governor Senator La Follette or something like that. Anyway, and La Follette at that time was one of the main senators to fight Woodrow Wilson, and Woodrow Wilson's involvement in the European War, even before 1917, you know. It's a very interesting,
Well, then who's behind this expansive U.S.? Of course, you mentioned Wall Street.
Right, it's the main factor. Wall Street and the American industry, American economy in general, which is being ruled by Wall Street, of course.
Okay.
We all know who's ruling Wall Street, you know.
Yeah. And then would something like, I'm not thinking of, what's that well-known bank, Goldman Sachs, is a part of Wall Street?
Goldman Sachs and, yeah, all those boys.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
They're dealing in, trillions and quadrillions. They're throwing away a lot of money, other people's money, including India and China and Indonesia and God knows who else, Germany's money. And they're all trying to get more of it. And now they're trying to establish a closer economic union between Europe and the United States, which would mean the Wall Street would have even more influence, more power in Europe to grab as much money and as much power as they can for Wall Street.
Now, why is Europe, the European countries, why do they go along with the United States the way they do? Do they have to? But then I'm thinking of the European Union now. Is that an apparatus of Wall Street?
Pretty much, right? And they're all dominated by NATO. You know, the thing is, when the Soviet Empire collapsed in 1991 and before, NATO should have been dissolved because there was no more threat, no great power that was threatening NATO or North America. They should have just gone home, you know. But actually, after that, NATO was expanded, and now that NATO is fighting in Afghanistan, and they're thinking about having NATO troops in Africa and God knows where, in the Antarctic, fighting the penguins in the service of Wall Street. And that's ridiculous.
Okay.
It's really totally countervailing, you know.
So we should all, everybody should take any money they have out of stocks. But if what's wrong is why that can't happen is because all these things that people are part of, like retirement plans or service industries, are all invested in Wall Street. They're not personally, they don't personally run that. But do you think Wall Street is something that is not just the stock market, that if the stock market would somehow crash and never not come back again or something, would there still be a Wall Street?
Well, yes, it's all tied together, of course.
Sure.
But it's huge. It's a conglomerate economic machine with various extremely powerful banks that are running America's, the world's economy, or at least trying to run it. And we all know who they are, you know, Goldman Sachs and all these other boys.
Well, then where do the you say that Russia is not strong enough, and it never has been. It kind of, the strength of the Soviet Union came because they had joined with the Allies in World War II, and they ended up with a lot of territory and a good position.
Right, that's right. Stalin himself said that he could not, or the Soviet Union could not have progressed to victory unless it had been backed to the hilt by Roosevelt and Churchill, especially by Roosevelt, who kept sending Stalin all these tremendous amounts of aid, especially military aid and some extent food, which was given to the upper echelons of the Communist Party and most of the Russian peoples and all the other peoples living in the Soviet Union saw very little of it. But anyway, this huge aid that was extended by Roosevelt primarily and secondarily by Churchill helped Stalin to expand his empire and to progress the great conquest that they did in Central Europe all the way to the Elbe River in the heart of Germany.
Well, do you think that since the then the Soviet Union collapsed, now it's a new kind of a thing with Putin in charge. And do you think that would ever it would ever have been the power that there was something of a world power? But would it? What am I trying to get at here? Where does it stand today? Is it so weakened now from what it was under Stalin? Is it weaker today than what it was under Stalin?
Well, militarily, yes, it's weaker. But economically, actually, it might be better off because of the huge oil and gas resources in eastern Russia, that is in Siberia, the Arctic, and various places in east of the Ural Mountains, mostly. and it's got so much oil and gas, they can pretty much, well, maybe blacklist, I'm saying too much, but influence Central and Western Europe, you know, especially Germany.
Well, is it in a position to keep that secure, or could they be attacked by, say, NATO and the Wall Street and have that taken over if it was desired to do that, or are they strong enough to defend their interests?
You know, they're facing each other. You never hear anything about that, about those small countries in the Caucasus, like Georgia and Armenia and Azerbaijan, and there's smaller splinters in between them. The American soldiers are on one side, and the Russian soldiers are on the other side. There's just a couple of hundred meters difference between them. They're eyeing each other, and they're not fighting each other yet. But you can very easily, you know, picture a situation in which they might start fighting for the resources, for the oil and for the gas, and, of course, for the geopolitical position, because that whole area is the door, you know, the hinge of the door between Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. And whoever rules, say, Eastern Turkey and Armenia and Azerbaijan, and all those other small splinters, Georgia, really is in a position to rule all of Europe and all most of Asia and all of the Middle East.
Well, how did they? How were they allowed to become independent then? Or is it, was it just
once they became independent? Those little countries became independent first after the First World War. That is after 1917. The Russian Revolution, most of those became independent, and so did the Ukraine. And then again, of course, now in, after 1991, those countries became independent again, and many of them hate the Russians, whether communists or non-communist terrorists. Some of them have been fighting the Russians for 150 years, you know, since the middle of the 19th century.
Well, yeah, it's like, so your closest neighbors are the ones that that fight the most, that have the most animosity to one another. So these people don't consider themselves Russian. Do they consider themselves Slavic? Are they? What are they?
Those countries are a mixture. Like the Georgians are neither Slavic nor Semitic nor Turkish, but they have some kind of a ancient nation that's existed for probably thousands of years in the mountains of the Caucasus, you know, parts of it. And some of the others are Muslim or Christians, like the Armenians. It's in some ways very confusing, but the goal of dominating all those countries is really very attractive to those people, as I said, who would try to dominate and rule Europe and most of Asia and the Middle East, because they can do it from the rooftop of the Caucasus Mountains and grabbing hold of the oil and gas pipelines. And up to now, Uncle Sam has been doing most of the expansion and aggrandizement. But let me say one more thing.
Yeah.
When you go into the Soviet, the former Soviet Union of Germany, more or less east of the Elbe River, and Thuringia, which was always considered central Germany, when you go there, that was given to the Russians in 1945, and actually before the 1943 at the conference in Tehran, you notice there, a huge number of Russian tourists out there, you know. There are very few in the Western Germany, but a lot of them are in what used to be the Soviet zone of Germany, especially in a town like Quedlinburg, of course, when you say Quedlinburg, nobody heard of that in Britain or in America, you know. Quedlinburg happens to be the famous monastery church where the first, what might be called, the first German king was buried, Henry the First of Saxony. And he was the one who consolidated the power of the various German tribes, or various German dukedoms, in 919. And so it lasted for exactly 1,000 years, from 919 under King Henry the First until the so-called Peace Treaty of Versailles in 1919, exactly 1,000 years. And anyway, Henry the First is buried at Quedlinburg. And when you get out, of course, you do see quite a few German tourists, but you also see a lot of Russian tourists. What the hell are the Russians doing there, you know, at the birthplace of the, what might be called the German nation, of the successor state to the Carolingian Empire before 1919. Well, they're there because they know this used to be the Soviet zone before 1990 or 1989, and therefore it's ours, you know, in the terminology of Russians. This is ours.
You think that ordinary Russians have those kind of feelings then?
But yes,
that,
they do.
They want that back. Or they want as much as they can get.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And what might happen is that with the economic situation getting worse and worse in Europe, whenever that happens, you know, then that might be, with all the tremendous help and aid that's been given to the left-wing politicians in Germany today, in Bonn, especially in Berlin, that they will pull a coup d'etat and unite with the Russians, you know.
Wow.
And that some of them might... they might call out a new Soviet zone of Germany with the capital in Berlin and ally with the Russians. And this might happen.
So then there we get to down to where it's interesting, really interesting to me, because where the Slavic, they're still alive, this Slavic, pan-Slavic or Slavic dominating thing versus the Germanic people and the other European people. Is that still going on?
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. But there was a number of tragic and also very stupid mistakes made by some Western politicians, especially by Woodrow Wilson, who really hated Germany and who in all his might tried to bring about a strong Poland and a strong Yugoslavia and a strong Czechoslovakia, which then became a satellite state of France in 1919, you know. And so that was very foolish of Woodrow Wilson, and of course even more foolish by people like Clemenceau and Poincaré, who were the prime ministers and the presidents of France at that time, in 1919, 1920. But then it was worsened. It was made worse in 1939 and 1943, 1945 by Roosevelt and by Winston Churchill, who again turned against Germany 100% instead of utilizing her as in the past as a bulwark against a Russian expansionism from the East, you know, a Russian or Polish expansionism from the East. Right now, German politicians really don't have much of a choice. They can either stay by themselves and be caught between the two opposing blocks and be ground to pieces, or go with the West and then have to fight against the East, or go with East and have to fight against the West, and then again being slaughtered by both of them, you know.
So well, they're not going to do that again. I know one thing they don't want is a repeat third time.
That's why we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that, but is it going to happen? I don't know. But anyway, the foolish thing is that Woodrow Wilson and Churchill, and then especially Franklin Roosevelt, you can't say trust in Russia, they focused too much on hating Germany without seeing that Germany wasn't really the only political and cultural, especially cultural, bulwark against aggrandizement from the East, from the Russians, and from the Poles.
Okay, well, this is so interesting. I've got some questions to ask you when we come back. We're going toward our break now, Dr. Vesterlay. We're going to be listening to a beautiful German Lied by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, so I'm sure you'll like that. But take 5 minutes off here, and we'll be and keep your phone line open, and we'll be back. Will that be all right with you?
Why, certainly.
Yeah. Okay. And you know, while we're waiting, I shouldn't talk right in. We've got 10 seconds, so I'll just say again: this is what we're going to be listening to, is the Gute Nacht song from Schubert's Winterreise.
It's very beautiful.
Yes.
Fremd bin ich eingezogen, fremd zieh ich wieder aus, der Mai war mir gewogen mit manchem Blumenstrauß. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. Das Mädchen sprach von Liebe, die Mutter gar von ihr. Herren Haus.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here, Carolyn Yeager, on the Heretics Hour on March 31st, 2014. And I'm here with Dr. Andreas Vesterle, who has had his long career as a professor of several subjects, but he has a great knowledge of geography and history of the entire Western world, and including the Middle East and so on. So we're discussing the topic of Slavism versus Germanism and many other aspects of it. So where we stopped, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Vesterle, if let's see, do you think that the Slavs feel anti-Europe?
Well, not necessarily. Some of them might, but we have to remember that there are several subdivisions among the Slavs themselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There are three points that we should remember: that certain Slavic people, especially the Poles, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Croatians, Slovenians, are, of course, they speak Slavic, and possibly they're descended from the Slavic peasants that moved them in the 6th and 7th centuries A.D. It's not a very long time ago, after the breakdown of the Western Roman Empire. But at the same time, both countries, like Poland and the Czech nation and the Slovak nation, Croatia, so strongly mixed with Germanic splinters or Germanic groups. Like among the Poles, the aristocracy, whatever remains of it, is to a large extent descended from Germanic tribes and Germanic empires, especially the Goths and the Vandals, who established very large empires in Eastern Europe, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea, you know. And some of those people remain behind also in the Ukraine and White Russia.
Oh, yeah, the Ukrainians.
Other parts of Russia, and then they migrate to Spain, right? And to Portugal, today is Portugal. and also acquire the Croatian aristocracy, also to a large extent dominated by the Germanic tribes of the Goths, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths, that moved through that area, what now is Croatia and Dalmatia and the area south of the Danube and the Drau and Savia rivers and all that stuff. So they're not really totally racially speaking, but their DNA is not totally Slavic, even though the peasant Slavic DNA and mentality might predominate. Now, in Russia, that's true.
Okay, so far we've got the Slavic nations are Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Croatia, Slovenia, right. Ukraine, right. And White Russia. Did I leave somebody out there?
Well, you left out the Muscovite Russians, I think.
Now, yeah, you know, I hate to break in with this, but I was going to ask that earlier. What is this business about the Muscovite Russians versus other Russians? What's that?
Well, it's a rather involved history, which is becoming very critical at the moment. Again, but the first Russian kings actually descended from Viking conquerors. They're called the Rurik kings. Rurik king, you know, the famous Viking conqueror. And Vladimir and all those people, the first Russian king, had his court in Kiev. And it was only after the Mongol invasion around 1240, 1241, around those decades, or many centuries after that, that all of Russia came under the dominance the rule of the Mongols or the Tartars.
Oh, and so the Tatars, how do you pronounce that? They spell it without an R, but people call it Tartars. Or is there a difference? The T-A-T-E-R-S. Who are they?
Well, Tartars are usually the successors to the Mongols.
So the Muscovites, are the more the Mongols.
Well, not exactly. The Muscovites are the Slavs who were subjugated by the Mongols, and they became sort of administrator for the Mongol Empire. And as time went on, the Mongol Empire became weaker and weaker because it relied too much on tyrants, on great personalities like Genghis Khan and Timur Leng and all those people. And after these people died, the empire pretty much fell to pieces. And then the administrators in Moscow, or centered about Moscow, were able to rise and then step by step throw off the Tartar yoke and then begin to conquer the rest of the Russian peoples, like Kiev and northern Russia, like Novgorod and Pskov, and all the great, like Venice, a great commercial aristocracies in northeastern Russia that was all conquered by, among other people, by Ivan the Terrible. And Ivan the Terrible then was the last Rurikid, the last of the Russian Tsars descended from the Vikings. But he was said to have been more cruel and more vicious than the Mongols themselves, you know, so, especially when he conquered Novgorod and those ancient merchant republics in north.
Oh, the Vikings were worse than the Mongols, huh? I mean, more cruel.
Oh, what's that again?
The Vikings were more cruel than the Mongols?
Well, not the Vikings themselves, no. But their descendants.
Like
Ivan the Terrible, who lived in the, you know, 15th and 16th centuries.
Yeah. Is there a more what word were we just using? More of that quality in Slavs than in Germanics and other Europeans. The quality of brutality or terrorizing and so on.
Possibly. Or at least the long history of brutality that took place in Russia, especially in Muscovite Russia, even before the Mongol conquest and then during the Mongols, then after that by the various power-hungry Tsars, especially Ivan the Terrible, and after him, the new dynasty of the Romanovs, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great, even though many of them were not of Russian descent, they tried to aggrandize themselves and try to strengthen Russia to make it more powerful, number one, by expansion to the outside, especially south into the Ottoman Empire, and south into the Persian Empire, eastern Turkey, and by expansion to the inside, by ruling their subjects with even ever more greater brutality and effectiveness, and trying to degrade the subjects, many of the subjects, especially the peasants, to almost a slave-like state, you know, serfs were not allowed to leave the village in which they lived and all that.
Well, when you treat people like that over a long period of time,
over centuries, yeah.
Yeah, what happens to those people? I mean, what do they become? They sort of submissive, don't they?
Yes, to some extent. Some of them, right, of course, escaped by becoming Cossacks. they escaped the steppes and built up a kind of a horse-based culture, which enabled them to escape the secret police of the Tsars, at the same time which enabled them to fight against the Turks and the Tartars. So all of that, yeah, there definitely was a lot of brutality, yeah. But then on the other hand, you know, I would say that every human being on every nation, at least potentially, has a lot of cruelty or brutality to it, in addition, of course, to all the other more humane and attractive and civilizing aspects, you know. So you can't just say, oh, the Russians are all cruel and brutal. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we should fight them. You know, it's not as easy as that.
No. No, well, where was the, you know, I think of, I know about the Poles, well, mostly they had quite an aristocracy, and the aristocracy kept the peasantry in, you know, in ignorance and so on. And
right, except for a few
now, what about
people.
These, yeah, what about the Slovaks? Were they that way too? And what about the Croatia and Slovenia? All I know about Slovenia is that during the World War One and after, they were very nationalistic, and they wanted to break away and have their own nation.
Right, and they tried to take a big chunk out of southern Austria.
Yeah, they were really pretty competitive with the Austrians, who were, you know, hadn't done them any harm. But they were nationalist Germans, so, you know, that's where that big break was there.
Yeah, it's a very long story. But the thing is, especially with Slovenia and also in Slovakia, many of the big cities in Slovenia are actually German, you know. Ljubljana, the capital, the real name is Laibach. Nowadays, hardly anybody knows it. And the second city, which is very similar to Salzburg, is Maribor. What's it called in Slovenian? Maribor. Maribor is Slovenian, but the real name is Maribor. And there are hundreds or thousands of villages and small towns, and between them, they used to be German before 1918, you know, German speaking and German culture. But now they're being oppressed and held down by a kind of a nationalistic Slavic autocracy.
Yeah, so there's this suspicion and what they're wary of the Germans coming back and taking over again, or, you know, taking back what they thought was theirs or something. So they're very wary, aren't they? I mean, that's the way I see them.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
And that does that go all kind of all the way through the Slavic peoples, a kind of a worryness that no.
I would say no. As far as the Poles are concerned, of course, there are various people with different mentalities, different opinions, but the Poles dream of their great past, you know, great Duke King of Bolesław Chrobry, who lived around 1030, 1040 AD, which was a long time ago, and he conquered, or at least took in, occupied parts of what today is Eastern Germany and Bohemia and Slovakia, and he conquered Kiev. Now, if you were going to go according to those standards, to take every area that Boleslav Chrobry occupied or conquered around 1030, 1040, 1050, Poland would have to be in constant warfare with all of its neighbors, including the Ukrainians. And that's why the Ukrainians really hate the Poles, you know. But then after that, starting in the 15th century, end of the 14th century, came the great Lithuania-Polish Empire, and it was even bigger because the Grand Duke of Lithuania was a heathen, and his entire people was heathen. They built up a large empire in Eastern Europe, married the princess, the royal princess of Poland, named Hedwig or Jadwiga in Polish, and established a huge empire in Central and Eastern Europe. And now they're dreaming again, dreaming about that, you know. And they had a very intelligent spokesman fighting for those goals by the name of, working right here as the American advisor to President Billy Carter.
Oh, yeah, that Polish guy. Is the big near Brezhnev or what? You're thinking about Brezhnev?
Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Brzezinski, yeah, okay.
Yeah, Zbigniew Brzezinski. And he, through his diplomatic artistry and his intelligence, you could say, was able to convince not just President Carter and his advisors, but various parts of the American ruling class that it would be very good to keep Germany down all the time, but to make Poland powerful so that Poland would be able to extend its sphere of influence from the Mosul and the Rhine rivers in the west all the way political geography, or geopolitically, all the way at least to the Volga River or the Ural Mountains in the east. And therefore, Poland should be a checkmate against Russia, you know. In other words, going through those motions that the Lithuanian-Polish Empire did in the 16th century and part of the 17th century, when Smolensk, which is the heart of Russia, just 300 kilometers west of Moscow, Smolensk was a Polish city. Now, some of them are still dreaming about that, as most probably is Zbigniew Brzezinski, and the president of Poland, who happened to be the leader of that port, the port city of Danzig, gave, anyway, that he was president of Poland. He gave Zbigniew Brzezinski the greatest Polish decoration, non-military decoration, was given to Brzezinski. Why was he given that? Not because he was for peace, but because he was instrumental in changing the railroad tracks, you know, so to speak. So that Poland will become the most important nation, the most important state in Europe, at least west of France. Than anything west of France, all the way up to the Volga, possibly, or geopolitically, to the Ural Mountains, could be dominated by the Poles and not by the Russians. Now, that's, of course, totally foolish.
What did you say?
Russians would never stand for that. But,
that's foolish. Yeah, why are the Poles so ambitious like that? They don't seem to get over it.
Yeah, they're still dreaming about that Lithuania-Polish Empire, which was very huge around 1600, 1550 and all that, uh-huh. And defeating the Turks and all that, which would be very nice. But
what kind of a nation was that, that Polish-Lithuanian Empire? How did the people live in it? How advanced was it? Or was it just that they had won all that territory?
It was multinational. First of all, the Lithuanians were there, who at first were heathens. They were pagans, and they were converted by Jagiello, the Grand Duke, they were converted by force to become Christians around that time of 1384 or whatever it was. They had conquered a large area. So when Jagiello married Jadwiga, the Polish princess, he brought a huge part of his own empire and added it on to Poland. And then on top of that, this empire included many Germans, millions of Germans, millions of what today would be called Ukrainians and White Russians and Jews and various other principalities, Tartars from the east. So it was a multinational empire. It was not a national or a nationalistic empire, what the Poles, that the Poles are dreaming about at the moment. You know, it just was not.
Well, okay, now let me ask this question, and I know it's probably, I know it's oversimplified, but what is the main, what would you say is the main difference between, what is the main common denominator among Slavic people? What kind of characteristics or what makes them all know that they're Slavic and what makes them hold together like that? And or well, do they not hold together?
The main tie, of course, is the language. They all speak Slavic languages.
Okay.
But those languages are very, very different from each other, or have become very different in the past 10 centuries, you know. And
are there too many differences among them for any pan-Slavism to work? I mean, is the idea of pan-Slavism really impossible because they wouldn't, they couldn't agree enough?
First of all, they're totally different from each other culturally and religiously because especially the Slovaks, the Czechs, the Croatians or the Croats and also the Slovenians are belong to the western part of Christianity. They're the ones who owed allegiance or supposedly owed allegiance to the Pope in Rome.
Yeah.
And many of the other Slavs, especially the Serbs and the Bulgarians and the Ukrainians and the Muscovite Russians and the White Russians, are Orthodox, and they all, at least originally owed their allegiance to the Eastern Roman emperors in Constantinople. And they were very strongly influenced by Orthodox Christianity. Now, what happened in Christianity was that Orthodoxy developed so-called Caesar of Papism, that we all know about. Now, Caesaral papism is a form of synthetic state or conglomerate state in which the Caesar or the Tsar or the Emperor would take over most of the functions of the Pope or the leading priest. There will not be a Pope in the sense of a Roman Pope, but there will only be a leading administrator or leading spokesman for the Orthodox Church, but he would, in most cases, be subject to the power of the Tsar and the power of various other Slavic kings, like in Russia and to some extent Bulgaria and so on.
So now Bulgaria is another Slavic
country. Right. And,
what about Albania? What is that?
Albania is a mixture. They claim to be descended from the Illyrians. Illyrians were a group of tribes related to the Celtic peoples. They originally lived in all Eastern Germany, Bohemia, Slovakia, that area. And then most of them moved south to before the Mediterranean, what later on became Illyria, what the Romans called Illyria. And the Albanians, at least the leading Albanians, claim to be descended from them. And they speak it in the European language.
I just remembered Serbia. Serbia is another Russian Orthodox Slavic
nation.
Right.
They have very strong ties to the Russians. When you read, Anna Karenina by Tolstoy, Anna's boyfriend, or whatever you want to call him, volunteers to fight for the Serbian brethren against the Ottoman Empire. And there were many thousands, maybe, God knows, hundreds of thousands or millions of Russians at that particular time in the 19th century who were trying to support the Serbs against the Ottoman Empire. Of course, what happened was that these were all included in the Muscovite Russian expansionism that had been going on, well, for many, many centuries, since Ivan the Terrible, but he was not terribly successful with that. In the east, he was here. Ivan the Terrible conquered Astrakhan at the mouth of the Volga River, and he conquered Kazan, which is many, many miles east of Moscow, on the Kama River, and east of the Volga River, and he conquered that with the aid of a German engineer who constructed a big cannon for him. But anyway, he did that, but he was Ivan the Terrible was unsuccessful in pushing west to a large extent. But after that came various others, especially Peter the Great, and he invaded what today is Romania, Bessarabia, and those people. And he annexed him after several defeats by the Ottoman Empire, which at that time was still pretty strong but corrupt. He annexed part of the northern coast of the Sea of Azov. The Sea of Azov is north of the Black Sea, east of the Crimea. That is very successful, especially Catherine the Great, who happened to be a German princess from a tiny duchy in northern Germany, west of Berlin. She became a very powerful Russian national leader, and she then, step by step, conquered the Crimea. So when Putin today talks about the Crimea being Russian forever, this of course baloney, because it wasn't Russian at all. Before the Russians got there, it was occupied by the Turks and by the Tartars, and especially by the Goths, because many of the Goths fled into the Crimea to get away from the Huns in the 4th century, the 5th century AD. And allegedly there were state people in the 18th century who spoke the Gothic language in the Crimea. And I myself knew a Turk at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison, who was red-headed. He said that his parents came from the Crimea, so he must have been in part Gothic, of Gothic descent. Anyway, so now Putin...
It's funny. It's so funny for me to think of Goths as red-headed, because for some reason, must be these current craze about these people that dress in black and so on and call themselves Goths. That I always think of gods as being dark and black-haired and so on, but they're not.
Yeah, all, some of them are, yeah, but not all of them. There's some blonde ones because the area around Ankara, today's capital of Turkey, was actually captured by the Celtic people, B.C. The Celtic peoples at that time in the 4th centuries B.C. were very powerful. And they moved, some of them moved east through Greece into Asia Minor, when that was Turkey, and some of them settled around Ankara, and they continued speaking their language, and some of them pushed in the service of the Persian Empire, which at that time was very huge. Some of them pushed south into Palestine, the various places, and what today is Palestine and Jordan, they were originally called Gallipoli, that is, City of the Gauls. And allegedly, the people of Galilee, what today is supposed to be part of northern Israel, were originally at that time descended, at least in part, from the Celtic warriors who moved down from Asia Minor and who settled in Palestine. So these Galilee peoples that gave us Jesus Christ were actually Celtic descent, at least in part. They were a mixed race.
Okay, so now you just said that the Galileans were were mixed, were part Celtic.
Yes.
Yeah, so Jesus Christ could be a red-headed...
Well, we don't know him.
Man, I've heard a lot of people who think they've seen Jesus say that he had red hair. Well, that's one, you know, that's in that
it's
mystical
really,
thing.
It's really not that important.
No.
It's all interesting to think about all those points.
Well, yeah, let me get back to this. I wanted to ask this. We have this religious division between the Slavs, Slavic nations, between the Roman Catholic and the Russian Orthodox. How much of a difference does that make? I mean, how important is that? And do they kind of gather based on
them? For them, it does make a difference, like the enmity between the Poles and the Russians, in part goes back to the fact that the Poles are Catholics and the Russians at least used to be Orthodox Christians. Mm-hmm. And the Czechs and the Slovaks and the Croatians, especially the Croatians, because they fought for centuries together with us, fought against the Ottoman Empire in the Balkans, they're very strongly Catholic. And that was one reason why there's, even today, there's strong enmity between the Croats and the Serbs. You can even see that here in Milwaukee. A friend of my father's, who my father got a job at one of these industrial establishments in Milwaukee here. He was mm-hmm. supposed to be a tool diamond, but anyway, he was working for one of the big factories on the south side of Milwaukee, and he was shocked by the fact that some of the workers who were Croatians or Serbs went after each other with their knives in the factory while they were working. They got into arguments about politics, about their history, and mm-hmm. they went after each other with their knives. They wanted to kill each other.
Hey, that's really interesting. I'm glad you got that in. We just had a caller call in, Dr. Vesterle. So let's let him come in and see what he wants to say. Hi, caller.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, it's John King.
This is John King calling you from deep southern Indiana.
Okay.
And, I would have liked to have been here a little earlier because I believe you're discussing the myths about the occult origins of the Third Reich?
No, it's changed because you haven't been listening to the program, huh?
I was looking for the link, actually, to listen to it live.
No, well, it changed it real suddenly, and Dr. Andreas Vesterle is here with me, and he's been telling us about the whole scheme of the Slavs versus the Germanics and all of this geopolitics and so on. And that's what we're talking
about. It's very descriptive, this whole Slavic, Germanic, and all of this infighting. It's nothing but a form of white genocide. And, I mean, that's all the
world. Okay, John. All right. Okay. But let's see what we're just kind of talking about history right now. So let's see what Dr. Vesterle says. And if you come up with something you'd like to ask, you can.
I'll try. I may be calling later then, okay?
Okay. All right. Sure. Thanks, John. All right. Well, he thought we were doing a different kind of program. And now his opinion is that Slavic versus Germanic is just white genocide because he's coming from that point of view. Now, what do you say about that, Andreas? What about this difference? Is it worth anything, or should it be forgotten about? But whose side is it the strongest? You know what I mean? I mean, how should we be led if we're going to be led as a unified people?
Well, that's the question of the moment, the question of the future. It's really hard to find an answer, a really true answer to that. On one hand, you should care for and nurture the cultural roots of the various people, including, say, the Poles or the Czechs or the Serbs and so on. At the same time, you should not be able to have their nationalism overboard, become aggrandizement, expansionism, total undying hatred, of their neighbors. That was really not true in the past. It was not true to a large extent in the Middle Ages, but it came about after the French Revolution. The French Revolution of 1789, especially the Revolution of 1848, which put great emphasis on nationalism.
Do you think nationalism is bad? I mean, like Thomas Sunich constantly he thinks that nationalism is bad in the sense that it is because being Croatian, he's Croatian, and he understands the like we were just talking about the hatred between the Croats and the Serbs and how they fight all the time, and he says it's just they're so pointless because they're so much the same, and then he also points to the Poles and the Germans. And I would like to say you've mentioned the problem between the Poles and the Russians. Would you say there's a bigger problem between the Poles and the Germans? And should that be, how do you overlook that when the Poles are demanding everything and from the Germans?
that's really unbridled expansionism and aggrandizement that really cannot be tolerated. And you would hope and pray, of course hoping and praying is not enough, that they would get over that. But usually what happens, and only with a series of defeats, do people see the illness of their ways, the things that they've done in the past, the 19th century, 18th century, whatever. Bismarck said, who was a great statesman, that it's the curse of the German people that they have to live between the two most nationalistic peoples in Europe, between the French in the West and the Poles in the East.
Well, then the Poles are saying, and it's also said about the Poles that it's their misfortune to be between Germany and Russia.
Yeah, that's what they claim. But we should also remember that the Poles were the only ones that succeeded in defeating Russia twice. First of all, at that time, the great Lithuania-Polish Empire was Smolensk, was a Polish city, and when they pretended to the crown of Russia, the false Dmitry was actually a satellite of Poland. And he was then got rid of by the Muscovites. But anyway, so those were the great days when the Poles had not proceeded as far east, and that's one reason why the Ukrainians hate the Poles so much, because they kept the Ukraine under subjection for many, many centuries. Mm-hmm. And the second time was in 1919-1920, mm-hmm. when Poland, supported by France, attacked Soviet Russia. You might say, oh, how wonderful that Soviet Russia would have been defeated by the Poles and by the French. Well, it didn't happen that way. And then the Russians counterattacked, and then there came the great miracle on the Vistula, in which, through a mistake of Stalin, who was one of the commissars on the Southern Front, the Poles counterattacked and were able to defeat the Russians, or defeat the Bolsheviks in southeastern Poland. And so, in general, then in 1920, at the Peace of Riga, Poland got a huge empire in the east, large parts of Ukraine, White Russia, parts of Lithuania, and, of course, through Woodrow Wilson, parts of East Germany. So, are we expecting to have to repeat that for a third time, you know? I don't think they should.
Well, so let's get, we've got 15 minutes left, so let's get on to something on a more, try to end up on a more positive note. I don't mean that we have to be positive, but I mean that what would be the solutions here? Is there any solution? Is there a way for Slavs and Europe, the Slavic East and the Europe to get along? People think that we should all be one. You know, we have in white nationalism the idea that we're all the same. We have to get over, just like John said, calling in, we have to get over these differences. But, you know, is it really a possibility, or is it possible in, you know, maybe in some long future time, or how would it go? How would it happen? Because how different are we? You know, how different are these two people?
Yeah, there is a possibility. But what's going on at the moment, you know, is they're all being, or they're seemingly being steamrolled flat by Wall Street and the various, the mechanistic, materialistic way of life of buying more stuff and buying another car, buying another fridge or whatchamacallit, a clothes dryer and a clothes washer and all that. All those things are really, most of them are really pretty unnecessary. I mean, the first step should be to get rid of that cheap, superficial, you know, mechanistic materialism that all denigrates all of us into really slaves of Wall Street. Or slaves of the fashions of buying, you know, all that stuff. We should get over that. Once we
how do we get over that when they're constantly pushing it to us? I mean, who would you say that the people in the East are better at that because they never got so deeply entrenched into it as we Westerners have?
At the moment, that's what it seems like, right? Of course, they're also hungering for another car or another refrigerator, clothes dryer, clothes washer, and all that stuff. But they're not as far along the road. And then, historically speaking, the people of the East, the Slavic peoples, maybe to some extent the Hungarians and the Romanians, have succeeded in preserving the so-called Titanic or Telluric tradition in their cultures, in which they're tied to the earth, Mother Earth and all that. And I can write about that for ages and ages and books and books. Whereas the people in Western Europe, especially in Germany, France, Italy, and especially in Britain and so on, have gone way out of their way in selling out to commercialism and to what comes along the road, you know.
So how much did the world wars have to do with that, do you think?
Well, all the destruction that went with the world wars, the First World War, especially the Second World War, all the huge expulsions of peoples much of those, or many of those cultures were undermined by all that negative stuff, all the destruction that was going on, and the expulsion, and the economic...
Yeah, they expelled a lot of good people. And they were the worst off for it. And then they got, of course,
right.
they became, taken over by the Soviet Union. And then you had all of those terrible years.
Therefore, you could say that actually people in general are good. They're not bad when it seems like they're not always out to cut the other guy's head off or to start a war against a neighbor. But that basically they're good. But what needs to be done probably is to establish a state that you can also call an establish an empire, like the Frankish Empire under Charlemagne, whose real name of course was Charles the Great. But anyway, in which various nations and peoples could live side by side and contribute toward cultural and also mechanical and scientific advancement. You could do that once you have a unified, strong political leadership, centralized political leadership, which would pretty much tell all these peoples and nations what to do.
Yeah, all right. Well, I think so, too. Now, who would this leadership be made up of? Could it be made up of delegates from every part of the whole area? Or would it have to be a certain people or something with a certain distinct point of view?
Well, it might be made up of delegates from all parts, you know.
Would they agree on things?
Once a strong government will be established, and that would be a good government that would contribute toward cultural and moral advancement, you know, not homosexual marriage and all that stuff, which is now being greatly... praised by Prime Minister Cameron of Britain. All that should be gotten rid of. But once you reestablish your true orientation, the true humane human nature the way it should be, and a correct faith also, and all that is vitally necessary to have a true belief and true faith. Once you have all of that, then it should be much easier to get along under the tutelage of a single government. Not a world government, but single government for Europe. Maybe outside of Russia, I don't know.
Yeah, do you think Russia could not go along with that? Russia is so used to dominating. And then how about Putin? Vladimir Putin today, he seems to be more along the line of forming this Russian-Eurasian Federation than he is by getting along with the West.
It seems that way. But on the other hand, he's also reacting towards the American aggrandizement,
right.
Wall Street aggrandizement into Europe. Into Eurasia, Afghanistan, Iran.
Yeah, right. Well, do you think then that Putin could be, would Putin be a way to begin? Do you think he could possibly be the leader that would put something good together for all the people of Europe, greater Europe?
I don't know about that.
he doesn't have that. You know, he was a KGB agent. I mean, I find that I don't think he's the great man that people would like to see him as right now.
Very cagey, you know. He's very cagey, and mm-hmm. he is definitely in the path of the great Russian leaders of the past, like maybe not Ivan the Terrible, but Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great and Alexander the First, who in part defeated Napoleon the First, and all those people who had a very strong influence on Europe. And he would definitely, Putin would very definitely like to have a stronger power in Western Europe. That's for sure.
Well, do you think, who then would be, who would be the right people to be forming this, to be pushing for this? I mean, you know, everybody in Europe is enslaved to the European Union. But if that breaks apart, I mean, you think that there's, they think that the Germans have any, anything going anymore, any possibility of reaching?
The possibility exists once you get rid of the present politicians, you know, because they're just slave drivers. Because the German people in its various countries, it's just a collection of slaves, really. It has been since, well, pretty much since 1919, the so-called peace conference of Paris. But and it has been the historic task of Germany in the past, since Charlemagne, you know, and since Charles the Great, to provide the center stage for merging the various regional and national cultures of Italy and Spain and France and England and Scotland, you know, Ireland, with the Bostonic or Telluric, the earthbound cultures of the East, especially the Poles and the Russians. And that, I think that task can be reestablished, and it should lead towards a truly united and free Europe. Not something dominated by Wall Street, or that's dominated by Muscovy, you know.
Ah, Muscovy. This Muscovy, I'm going to have to read up on that. I'm not... What is the problem with that?
Well, Muscovy is just another name of the great Russia, the Muscovite people, who emerged as the administrators for the Mongols and the Tartars.
But you're saying that they still are not a friendly group, or that they still have ambitions in the same way that the Wall Streeters have ambitions. I mean, for their own.
They seem to, right. Even though they're always in the second place. And, before 1914, they tried to imitate the British and have a world empire. And the British, through the Navy, and the Russians wanted to do it by land conquest, by going into Afghanistan and Tibet and Manchuria and so on. And it didn't work out for them. And before that, it was Alexander I defeating Napoleon Bonaparte. But he also did not succeed in establishing a large empire in Central or Western Europe, even though there was a Holy Alliance and all that. But Putin and some of his advisors don't seem to have given up the idea of dominating the rest of Europe all the way to the British Channel and the Iberian Peninsula. I think they still have their eyes on that. The way that Donoso Cortez prophesied in the first half of the 19th century.
Well, then, you know, it just seems to me that the Germans are situated in such a way that if they were be able to get out from under the yoke of the control of all these things, that they would be the best centralized area for having something that was for both the East and the West, you know, for being fair to both.
Right.
And could kind of pull it together. I don't see any other solutions there. Well, we've got 60 seconds, I think. I heard that little thing. So, 60 seconds, okay. We're not going to hear it. We're not going to hear the music. Well, Dr. Vesely, I'm really glad that you came on and we got this taken care of. And every time it seems like, even after an hour and a half or so, that we're just barely
new questions coming up.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and there's no easy answers, is there? I don't know. I mean, look out there, and it's just you're waiting to see what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your knowledge on all of this, and we're going to have to say goodnight now. So we'll say goodnight to our listeners, and I wanted to mention that next week I'm going to have an all-host show here on this on Heretics Hour.
Okay.
And okay. Well, thanks again, everyone, and thanks to you, Dr. Vesely. Good night.
It's a pleasure. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.